and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. As the country marks the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruling that made abortion legal in the United States, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a new case from the state of Texas that might have a devastating impact on the ability of women to access abortion services and other health care services. We will talk to a leader of the struggle in Texas to keep those rights for women. Peace talks in Geneva aimed at ending Syria's five-year-old civil war are due to begin on Monday. Now, whether they will happen at all is up for debate as tensions flare between Turkey and Russia over whether the Kurdish Democratic Unity Party should be included. It's official. The Israeli government is seizing more Palestinian land in the West Bank, the area seized by Israel in the June 1967 war. What are the implications of this latest land grab? But first, today marks the 43rd anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, establishing the legality of abortion in the United States. But those rights may be nearly wiped away depending on how the Supreme Court rules in a potentially landmark case from Texas. We are facing a new court case coming from the state of Texas that the Supreme Court will be hearing, and it may have a profound impact not only in Texas, but for women all over the country. We will talk to a leader of the struggle in Texas to keep those rights for women. Ana Rodriguez de Freitas is the Texas Latina Advocacy Network State Policy and Advocacy Director. She leads the organization's Texas State Policy Agenda, as well as supports the development and execution of its organizing strategies statewide. Ana, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
So talk about this decision that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear from the state of Texas. What is it? What's it called? And what's its impact?
Absolutely. So we're calling this the clinic shutdown bill because that's precisely what HB 2 will do if allowed to stand. What's going to be heard before the Supreme Court on March 2nd is one of the largest cases related to abortion access. And it stems from a bill that passed in 2013, which Wendy Davis famously filibustered here in Texas, but which ultimately did pass and has been partially implemented and has already resulted in the closure of nearly half of the existing abortion providers in Texas. So as an organization dedicated to access to reproductive health care, including abortion care for Latinas, we're particularly concerned and watching this very closely and taking action because, as you probably well know, Latinas in Texas already face formidable barriers to accessing health care. So this is a huge case. We have participated as expert witnesses in the Fifth Circuit, and here before the Supreme Court, the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health has submitted an amicus brief to the court as well, indicating why this is bad for all Texans, but particularly for Texas Latinas.
Roe v. Wade was passed during the Nixon administration. There was a huge, strong movement of women and, of course, men who were defending and supporting women's rights. Before that, abortion was not legal. That meant unless you were wealthy, you were frequently forced to get an abortion. A female person who did not want to have a child or could not have a child was forced to have abortions in the least safe, most dangerous kind of circumstances. So Roe v. Wade was designed to remedy that. It said, in essence, a woman has the right to control her own body. And yet we have a bill in Texas which says something other than that, although it doesn't challenge the essence of the Roe v. Wade prescription that women do have a right to legal abortion. How are they undermining abortion without undermining the premise of Roe v. Wade?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, we know access to be a problem today, 43 years after Roe v. Wade was passed. And we know that the movement has increasingly included more people of color, more people directly impacted to demonstrate that we need to reclaim Roe. Why do we need to reclaim Roe? That's because, well, because politicians can't directly outlaw abortion because it's constitutionally protected, what they do instead is what they've done with HB2 here in Texas is they pass unnecessary, medically inappropriate, and unnecessary barriers and obstacles to care. What do I mean by that? I mean forced ultrasounds. I mean required 24-hour waiting periods, as if a woman who has decided to have an abortion may somehow change her mind during that time, which we know not to be true. Also, HB2 in particular, the sections of the law that are being challenged before the Supreme Court include ambulatory surgical center requirements. That's the requirement that clinics operate like mini hospitals, which is completely medically unnecessary and serves only to create fiscal barriers for the clinics themselves such that they can't comply, they shut down, and access is reduced. The other section of the law that's being challenged is a physician's requirement that the physician have admitting privileges in nearby hospitals. Well, we know that for many communities, there is no hospital within 30 miles of the abortion clinic. We know also to be true that for political and other reasons, hospitals will refuse to grant admitting privileges to operating physicians. So again, another way to circumvent Roe and create obstacles that do everything but outlaw abortion. The result is the same. Access is denied.
So we have with HB2 in Texas, doctors who provide abortion services must obtain admitting privileges at local hospitals no farther than 30 miles away from their clinic. That's a requirement.
That's correct.
And every healthcare facility offering abortion care must meet building specifications to essentially become mini hospitals, also known, as you said, as ambulatory surgical centers. So now we have a situation, or maybe if this law is upheld, but you can explain the specifics, that with the requirements that 9 out of 10 of all of existing abortion clinics in a state with 5.4 million women of reproductive age, 9 out of 10 of those will no longer be open. And one fact I read is that it leaves more than 500 miles between San Antonio and the New Mexican border without a single clinic. So women have, this is what you're saying, women have the constitutional right, but the politicians are putting conditions and specifications on abortion providing clinics such that women could have the right, do have the right, but can't access the right. I mean, that's just right. Treating women as a punching bag. I mean, who's doing it?
Unfortunately, that's true. What you're describing is exactly right. It becomes a right on paper, but not in reality. Let me just, if I may, respectfully correct a couple of those figures. We do know that there were over 40 abortion providers in Texas prior to what we're calling the partial implementation of HB2. That's left us with 19 currently. If HB2 is allowed to stand, there would only be 9 or 10 to serve the over 5 million people that you just described. And you are absolutely correct that that would require huge distances, leaving clinics only operating in major metropolitan cities. And, you know, frankly, the fact that we're talking about reclaiming Roe is heartbreaking because, you know, we have the same situation we had 43 years ago, where only people with money, only people with the ability to take time off work, only people with the ability to secure childcare for the multiple visits that are now required, only with people with transportation, only with people with legal documented status that can cross internal immigration checkpoints will be allowed to travel. That is inexcusable, it's unacceptable, and it's why Latinos are watching.
Texas Governor Rick Perry declared at an anti-abortion rally that in an ideal world, it's one without abortion. Until then, we will continue to pass laws to ensure that they are as rare as possible. I mean, this is a fundamental right of women. How can Rick Perry or any of the politicians in Texas or anywhere say, you know what, we're going to make laws that make it almost impossible for women, not men, but women to access health care services that are constitutionally provided for them? I mean, how can the movement, how can the women's movement, how can your organization, what can you guys do that would really make a difference given the fact that this is obviously just targeting women, one particular part of the politician population for political purposes?
Well, that's a great question, too. You know, what we're doing is we're having conversations on a yearly basis about abortion access, about reproductive health care, about immigration. We're having these conversations in people's homes, in cafes, in churches, in community centers, in the lower Rio Grande Valley. We're talking in Spanish with people directly impacted, and those directly impacted individuals are the ones who will be leading a movement against such a rhetoric. You know, that rhetoric that you quoted is almost actually a gift, because at least in that instance, it was admitted that the intent behind these laws is to make abortion inaccessible. Because we know that so often the excuse is used that this is about health and safety for women. And this is absolutely not about health and safety for women. In fact, there is evidence to suggest that when you eliminate access to safe and accessible abortion, the risk goes up for women. So we are having conversations, like I said, every single day with Latinas. We're showing up. What we do at National Latina Institute that I'm most proud of is people directly impacted by these policies are the experts. It's not me sitting in my house in Austin, Texas, drafting a bill analysis. It's the woman in the Rio Grande Valley who was denied access to care. And over time, and we've been doing this since 2007, that woman becomes the leader. She is given the skills to share her experience and to mobilize other Latinas into action, and to bust myths, because another prevalent myth that exists about our community is that we are overwhelmingly conservative, that we are overwhelmingly anti-choice. And the reality is that Latinas hold compassionate, non-judgmental views on abortion. What my friends in the Valley would say to Rick Perry if they heard him say that is, you know what, yo te apoyo, I support you. That's your personal decision that you and your partner would make together. What we respectfully request is that you not interfere with ours. And that's it. We're not trying to change anyone's mind other than to create a culture where dignity, salud, respect exists. And that's what our movement is about.
The women who you talked about who would say to Rick Perry, the governor, well, that's your personal decision. They can't actually impose any sort of sanction on him or his family because they're too removed. And you're trying to organize them, mobilize them, have them speak, have their voices be heard. But nonetheless, absolutely, they're on the receiving end of this political grandstanding and political operation by conservatives or Republicans or by others who are making a lot of money carrying out these kind of campaigns to limit access to abortion rights. Let me ask you this. I mean, it seems to me we're here in Washington, D.C. Obviously, abortion rights are considered to be sacrosanct by a very big part of the population. Same in New York, same in San Francisco, same in Chicago, same in the big cities. But the right wing and the Republican Party attempts to take away abortion rights, not by stripping the legal right to have an abortion, but by limiting access. That's taking place in states like Texas or in areas like the Valley. In other words, more smaller areas, more distant from the big cities. And it seems like a disconnect because the great wellspring of support for women's rights and reproductive rights might be in these big cities, but the people there are sort of shielded or cushioned from the blows that, as you said, whole communities, very large tracts of working class women are facing in states like Texas.
Yeah, that's why it's important to talk about Texas as a whole and to talk about, to give voice to communities that have been marginalized and have not been heard or have been stereotyped to assume that they will think and vote a certain way. But you're right, when access is still available in the major cities, and there's no effort to make a connection to other parts of the state, be it the Rio Grande Valley or West Texas or the Panhandle, where access is absolutely a problem, then the issue doesn't see the light of day. That's what we're working to change, one conversation at a time. Today, in Austin, we are having a rally at the Capitol where we are launching a truth tour where several Texas cities, including Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas, San Antonio, El Paso, McAllen, will be stops along the way where people will be mobilized, the press narrative will be informed by people directly impacted and by people who support abortion access. We know that the vast majority of Texans support abortion access. We also know from our personal experience and from polling that we've conducted that Latino voters hold compassionate views about abortion, and 78% of them indicate that they do not want a politician interfering with that personal decision. Now, what we need to do and what we're working towards is holding politicians accountable, regardless of their political party, because this is something that needs to be translated as a priority to elected officials so that they know that we will not stand idly by.
One of the amicus briefs that was filed for the upcoming oral arguments in the Supreme Court case, the case from Texas, was from a very large group of mostly professional women, doctors, lawyers, academics, who said that at one time in their lives they had an abortion. That was very unusual for such a public sort of demonstration, acknowledgement of something that is considered, and rightfully so, such a private matter. Mm-hmm. There is an attempt to sort of rewrite the narrative because the conservatives have said abortion is just evil, it's sinful, it may be necessary sometimes under very, very limited circumstances, but it's not treated as anything other than a terrible decision that a woman might have to make. These women were saying, well, yes, it was a very challenging decision, very difficult decision, obviously, but it was an essential decision for my life. I wouldn't be where I am today if I did not have that right. In other words, mm-hmm. will this kind of outreach to other layers, other milieus, other parts of the population, can this make a difference with this particular Supreme Court?
I hope so. My hope is that the Supreme Court will vote to side with Texas families, and Texas values. And, you know, a friend of mine signed on to that brief. 45 amicus briefs were filed. And you're right, many of them included personal stories because we need to shift the narrative that women regret abortions because they don't. 95% of them do not regret their abortion. And the value in speaking up and out about our personal experiences is that it eliminates that talking point, that very toxic and frankly untrue talking point from the other side. This is a personal decision, but by sharing it in the form of these briefs and with the media, we are reclaiming the conversation. And it is one that, like you said, it's a nuanced decision. It's a big decision. But women can make decisions and do decide this for themselves every single day. The question becomes, are the resources available for them to turn those decisions into their reality? That's why we're fighting against HB2.
Anna, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining this discussion on the 43rd anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. We now turn to Syria. Peace talks in Geneva are due to begin on Monday to hammer out a political solution to the nearly five-year-old civil war under a roadmap agreed to by the UN Security Council in December. However, a major stumbling block now appears to be whether the Kurdish Democratic Unity Party, or PYD, will be included in the talks. Russia says they should be, while Turkey staunchly opposes the move. Turkey calls the PYD a terrorist organization and an arm of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. We are joined on the phone from Brussels by Adam Uzun, an executive committee member of the Kurdistan National Congress, or KNK. Uzun spent 10 months in prison in France after being arrested in October 2012 on charges of belonging to a terrorist organization. Welcome back, Adam.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Peace talks were expected to start in Geneva on Monday. Now they may not happen because of a conflict over whether to include the Kurdish Democratic Union Party, or PYD. What's happening?
I'm really not sure if they will take place or not. There are still discussions. There will be some discussions between Lavrov and John Kerry, and I think they have given their list now to the special envoy of UN, Mr. Stefan de Mistura. So there are a lot of names given to him, and he has to decide for these days. It is still not sure. Is it really opposing to have the PYD or to have the Kurds on the table? They are against it. They are pushing. They are making pressure on Turkey, on all the other coalition members. But that means Turkey does not want any solution for Syria, because Turkey is trying to prevent the Kurdish presence over there. And everybody knows that the Kurds are the really who are fighting against ISIS, who have defeated ISIS from several times. I think that attitude by Turkey trying to convince the international coalition not to have the Kurds in Geneva, it's a revenge.
Adem, let me ask you. I mean, I think it's shocking. I mean, the whole world saw Kobani. The people could see that it was the Kurdish military forces that are affiliated with the PYD, the Kurdish Democratic Union Party, the People's Protection Units. They're the ones fighting ISIL. They're the ones giving their lives. These heroic groups of men and women who have been seen all around the world as the main fighters against ISIL, along with perhaps the Syrian Arab Army, which has lost tens of thousands of men in this fight against Al-Qaeda and, of course, against ISIL. I mean, how could it be that Turkey or anyone would try to prevent the Kurds, having sacrificed so much in the fight against ISIL, from being part of the political process?
You're right, because the Turkish mentality, Turkish attitude is not to get rid of ISIL. Turkey is seeking to prevent any democratic system in Syria. Turkey is trying to prevent any Kurdish democratic rights in Syria. Turkey is trying to prevent any Kurdish status in Syria. You know, the Kurds have, with all the others, with Arabs, with Armenians, with all the other nations, they have fought ISIS very strongly. They have pushed back ISIL from a lot of areas. They have pushed back ISIS from Kobani. Everybody has giving their support for those forces. But it seems Turkey is anti-Kurdish. Turkey is anti-stability. Turkey is anti-democratic system in Syria. The Turks are trying making problems, and Turks want to continue the war over there. And Turks have intervened in several areas. They have shelled several areas in Syrian part of Kurdistan. They have shelled Gresipi. They have shelled Jarablus. Turkish forces of military vehicles and heavy equipment accompanied by mine detection and removal device. So after crossing the border, Turkish soldiers moved westward within in the Syrian territory. Turkey is shelling everybody every day the Syrian territory, and Turkey is trying to provocate the Kurds over there in Syria so to make the bases free for them to intervene militarily. Turkey is trying to change the demography over there. And after Turkey has seen that Kurds have pushed back ISIL and they are now going in revenge and fighting against the Kurds in Turkey, who helped the Kurds in Syria in fighting against ISIS? So that is, Turkey is really not seeking for a democratic solution, really not seeking for a stability in Syria, is really trying to make problems and is really trying to empower ISIL.
Let me ask you about the United States then. I mean, the United States is the leader of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The second biggest military in NATO is Turkey. Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. Clearly, Turkey is a traditional, historic, and military ally of the United States. The United States says it's committed to the UN peace process that follows up after the Vienna 2 meeting. In other words, a roadmap for peace, meaning ceasefires, maybe local ceasefires, then a national ceasefire, then negotiations between the Assad government and some parts of the opposition that are considered not terrorist. And then finally, nationwide elections so some new transitional or government of national unity can take place. I mean, the United States is for those things, and they're the ally of Turkey. What are they doing about Turkey's position?
I think it's true. Turkey is ally of United Nations. Turkey is ally of NATO. But even NATO and U.S. has to realize that the attitude of Turkey is not helping to defeat the enemy, in that case, ISIL. Turkey is helping logistically, helping financially ISIS. So therefore, Turkey is empowering the enemy of NATO and U.S. And U.S. has to realize that Kurds not only in Syrian part of Kurdistan, in general, Kurds are really fighting ISIL, really supporting each other against ISIL. So therefore, our suggestion for NATO or for U.S. Should be, they have to be more objective. They have to realize the new area in Middle East. The Kurds are not seeking to separate those states. The Kurds are not seeking to fight against other nations or other minorities. The Kurds are really want having a peaceful and democratic system in Syria, what the U.S. supposed to have to want to have over there too. So therefore, our suggestion for U.S. Should be to give Turkey a message: you cannot continue with that anti-Kurdish policy in Syria and in Turkey. You have to help us to fight ISIL. In that case, in Syria, Kurds are fighting ISIL. You have to be supportive for the Kurds. Kurds are your neighbor in the future. Do you want ISIL as neighbor or the Kurds who are seeking to have good relation with you?
Let me ask you what the Kurds do want. I mean, you're talking about a democratic Syria. What does that mean from the point of view of the Kurdish population? Are you seeking autonomy within a federated Syria? Are you seeking independence from Syria? What do the Kurds really want? What are you fighting for?
You know, the Kurds are really, they are seeking a democratic Syria and free Kurdistan within the border in Syria. Kurds once have their fundamental rights. Kurds once have the constitutional rights in Syria, living with the other nations, with the Arabs, with Armenia, with all the nations living in Syria together in peace. So Turkey, Kurds are not asking to separate Syria. Kurds are thinking like that. The slogan is, and free Kurdistan is guaranteed if we have a democratic Syria. For a democratic Syria, it needs to change the constitution. It could be a federative Syria. It could be a Syria where the other nations have their own parliament or own autonomy and central government. So therefore, I think the real aim of the Kurds is to have a democratic Syria and to have their own fundamental rights in the area where they can lead each other, where they can lead them freely.
Let me ask you about what you consider to be the prospects for a peaceful resolution or some resolution to the current Syrian civil war. There could be a military solution, meaning the Syrian Arab army led by Bashar al-Assad, now with the support of Russia's direct intervention and conspicuously defined intervention as an ally of the Syrian Arab army, and other anti-ISIL forces, including the Kurdish forces, there could be a military solution. What would a political solution or a negotiated solution look like from the point of view of the Kurds?
I think a military solution in Syria is impossible. So it should it needs really a political solution. But political solution with those opposition who are not living in Syria right now, who are outside in Turkey or in Qatar, and have no support within in Syria, with them to have a political solution is very difficult.
Who are they? What are the names of those groups? Is that the Free Syrian Army?
No. The opposition. I'm speaking about the opposition. And if you have this opposition who are very strong in the area, like the Kurds, like other oppositions, and if you have on a table all of them together, even the Syria, this opposition, which is strong in the area, in that case the Kurds, and some other oppositions, and with the international presence, to have a negotiation, maybe in Geneva 3, that is the best solution what we can find. So the opposition, the international coalition, and the Syrian government should sit and seek for a political solution.
And what are the Kurds, and what is your organization and the Kurdish groups you're affiliated with? How do you view the role of Saudi Arabia? How do you view the role of Al-Qaeda, the Army of Conquest, Al-Nusra? What's your attitude towards those entities, including Saudi Arabia?
You know, Al-Qaeda, Ahrar al-Sham, Al-Nusra, ISIL are the same. They don't want any peaceful solution. They are just attacking those groups who are looking for a democratic solution. And unfortunately, they are getting their support by Qatar, they are getting their support by Turkey, they are getting their support by Saudi Arabia. Maybe they have their own interest because of their own interest they are supporting them. Especially Turkey is supporting Al-Nusra, and is supporting ISIL. And the Turkey and ISIL, they have a fight, pre-arranged fight. Sometimes Turkey is attacking some areas which is belong to ISIL, but ISIL has already freed those ISIS. Turkey is attacking them. It's a pre-arranged fight. And after ISIL is withdrawn from those places, Sultan Murat forces supported by Turkey are replacing these places. So it is really a pre-arranged fight between ISIL and Turkey. Turkey is trying to put their own forces, Sultan Murat, if not Al-Nusra, if not Ahrar al-Sham, if not Al-Qaeda, in those places. For Turkey, it is not important if it is ISIL, if it is Ahrar al-Sham, if it is Al-Nusra. ISIL is now very well known in the international area. Nobody wants ISIL, so therefore Turkey has a pre-arranged fight with ISIL to convince ISIL, withdraw, I will put my own forces over there. So I think Al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, Al-Qaeda, ISIL is strongly supported by Turkey. The only reason why they are supporting them, they don't want any political solution, they don't want any democratic Syria, they don't want any Kurdish status over there.
Well, we'll have to see how it works out. We're out of time. Adam Uzun, he's an executive committee member of the Kurdistan National Congress, or KNK. We're talking about whether or not the Kurds, those who have been fighting ISIL in Syria, ISIL or Daesh or so-called Islamic State, will be included in the peace talks. And can there be peace talks without the Kurds? We will revisit this subject. Adam Uzun, thank you very much. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. The Israeli army announced that a new round of settlement building will take place in the West Bank, in the Jordan Valley. We're joined by Skype by Mahmoud Ahmed from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
What's the significance of this new announcement? This is the de facto annexation of another important part of the West Bank, no?
Absolutely. And in fact, a continuation of, you know, longstanding existing Israeli policies of appropriating Palestinian land, expanding the never declared borders of the illegal state of Israel in their, you know, constant never ending land grab. Not to mention the displacement, further displacement of additional indigenous Palestinian people, adding to the refugee population.
What's the significance of this particular land?
Well, it's, you know, the land of the Jordan Valley is obviously, you know, plays strategic interests in terms of proximity and access to water, in terms of bordering with Jordan. And in fact, we know that Israel has since prior to its inception, actually, you know, going back as we can go back all the way, you know, to the late 1800s. But if for this purpose, if we just started in 1944, we know 4 years prior to the partition plan and the creation of the illegal Zionist state, that in fact, the Zionists were already strategizing on how to kind of hoard as much of the water and other natural resources expanding Israel. You know, the ultimate goal is greater Israel and displacing as many Palestinians as possible.
Human Rights Watch has released a report urging businesses to comply with international humanitarian law and not conduct business in the occupied territories. How significant is business in the settlement areas?
Well, it's extremely significant. And, you know, frankly, and I applaud that call by Human Rights Watch. We could contemplate on whether or not the call should actually go further, but let's just take that as a starting point. Israel has, for, you know, many years, had a standing practice of expropriating, stealing land in the West Bank, you know, and basically basing business operations in these settlements. Well, they get the land for free. They utilize, you know, cheap labor, which is created, obviously, you know, de facto by a compilation of policies in Israel proper, so to speak, within the Green Line, but also within the West Bank. And it just becomes financially too easy of a, you know, financial gain for Israel and other companies around the world to profit off of the theft, the illegal theft of Palestinian land, the displacement of Palestinian refugees, and the inhumane treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank and throughout all of historic Palestine.
The Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, reacted with great seeming anger and fear when the EU, I believe it was the EU, the European Union, refused to allow products that were produced in the occupied West Bank to be sold as made in Israel inside of the European Union. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. You know, and Netanyahu's response to that is frankly not surprising at all. It's just indicative of exactly what we're talking about, the Zionist endgame of establishing a greater Israel, encompassing all of Palestine. And so therefore, when the EU takes even, you know, such a liberal position to say that, you know, they're recognizing the occupied West Bank as being Palestinian territory, that's obviously offensive to Netanyahu and other Zionists, because, you know, their strategy has always been an expansionist strategy. Israel has never declared borders, and they've never made qualms about the fact that they are actually employing an expansionist strategy and wish to annex all of historic Palestine, and in fact, parts of Syria and Lebanon and, you know, parts of and even parts of Saudi Arabia.
Let's talk about Israel as a settler government wanting to expand. Of course, we know in the United States, the European settlers who came here in the beginning of the 17th century also had expansionist designs. And there was an indigenous population, many millions of Indian people, native people. Eventually, in order to take their land, those big swaths of indigenous controlled territory were eliminated step by step by step using all kinds of methods of violence and terror, as well as other methods of coercion and bribery. But eventually, the United States government was able to secure the territory of North America for this settler government, also known as the United States of America. In the case of the Israeli settler government, they have attempted, it seems to me, to use similar methods to drive the indigenous Palestinian people off their land, but it doesn't really seem to work. I mean, it's working in terms of creating a huge amount of suffering, but the Palestinians are not leaving. Am I right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I appreciate tremendously the parallel and the comparison drawn between the American settler state and the Israeli settler state. And frankly, has a big part to do with what brings the American government and Israeli governments together on much of what they agree on. So, the Palestinians are not leaving. And I think, you know, the other let me back up for a second. I apologize. The other thing to take into consideration, which is a slight but significant difference between the time of, you know, the targeting of the indigenous native Indian in the States and the current targeting of the indigenous Palestinian, we're living in the age of media now. what the onslaught and the massacres and the displacement and all of the illegal atrocities that were effected upon the Native American Indian weren't publicized as the Palestinian situation is today. However, Palestinians have made it clear through generations of refugees now for approaching 70 years, and we're talking multiple generations, who have made it clear consistently that the only resolution, the only satisfaction that will address the needs of the Palestinian people as a nation of people, as individuals, is the right to return to our indigenous inalienable homes. And that is something that, you know, from a child who was maybe 3 or 4 years old to an elderly person who's 80 or 90 years old, that's something that is common across the Palestinian dialect, which is the fact that we have a right to exist as a people and in our country and, you know, to govern ourselves.
A senior politician in the Zionist Union Party, Isaac Herzog, proposes building a wall around all Israeli settlements. How prevalent are views such as his in the Israeli political establishment?
He's not speaking out of place, frankly. Look, we've already seen the apartheid wall, which is, we all know now, you know, over the course of many years, spans as high as 60 or 70 feet in some places. Look, Israel will continue to employ a variety of tactics as outlined in various Israeli documents introduced into or through the Israeli parliament. And in fact, some of the very, documents that serve as the foundation of the illegal Zionist state, going back as far as 1897 and reaffirmed again in 1944, 4 years prior to the UN partition plan, again in 1948 and 1953, and multiple times throughout the years affirmed by Israeli parliament, which basically spells out specifically using the variety of tactics which they have used, including, you know, legal, creating a set of circumstances through building of walls, limiting access to water, expropriating, you know, stealing land, expelling Palestinian people, imprisoning Palestinian people of any age, you know, men, women, and children. And so this is spelled out and they've shown us clearly over the years that they have no qualms whatsoever about using a full variety of tactics, including the use of biological and chemical weapons historically. And they will continue to do so. And they will continue to build walls as long as their illegal and inhuman activities are financed and supported largely in the U.S., but, you know, businesses all over the world that continue to do business illegally with an illegal state.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we know from history, from the example of how the settler government in South Africa, which declared apartheid, declared that black people could not be equal to white people, took the lands of the indigenous population, used the indigenous population, the African people, essentially as low-wage workers or a form of virtual involuntary servitude. They were finally undone by the international community's boycott and sanctioning efforts against South African apartheid government. That made a big difference to them, that isolation. Up until then, they not only had Dick Cheney and American politicians calling Nelson Mandela a terrorist and enforcing anti-terrorist laws against the ANC, the African National Congress, but they also had all of the Western corporations there getting lots of profits and doing lots of trade. Now we have the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, that aims to combat trade conducted not just in the settlements, not just in the West Bank or East Jerusalem, but in Israel in general. In other words, a tactic borrowed from the anti-apartheid movement that brought down or helped bring down the South African racist government in the 1980s. How effective has the BDS movement been? Will it be a major factor in politics for Israel, for Palestine?
Well, we have seen a multitude of victories and successes on the BDS front, including, you know, popular artists refusing to perform in Israel, as well as a variety of businesses slowly, aligning themselves with the Palestinian people and with the BDS movement by withdrawing their operations and funds from Israel. We've seen a number of churches, some labor unions. And so the BDS movement, which is still relatively, you know, young, right? I mean, we're talking 10, 11 years since the actual call. But the BDS movement is definitely gaining momentum. And if we can use as a barometer, and I don't like to use these terms normally, but just for the purpose of this discussion, if we can use as a barometer for how, you know, significant or impactful the BDS movement has been thus far, we need only look to the reaction by the Zionists and of the Zionists to the BDS movement. And other, you know, colonial imperial countries or historically that are still sympathetic to the Zionist policies of Israel, like France, for instance, which makes, you know, Palestine Solidarity and BDS, or is attempting to make Palestine Solidarity and BDS illegal. But we see people, you know, still coming out in support of BDS and in support of Palestine. And so, look, Israel cannot continue to maintain its status quo without the full financial gain that, you know, is set up through the kind of the Zionist infrastructure maintained through the occupation and the ongoing genocide the Palestinian people and the expropriation of Palestinian land.
There's a similar law that would make it illegal to try to boycott Israeli products, something that BDS movement is doing. That's winding its way through the New York State legislature right now, by the way. So similarly, you know, it was illegal during the 1950s when Martin Luther King carried out economic boycotts against businesses in southern states. So let's talk about what the impact of the decision by the Israeli military to essentially annex this fertile area in the Jordan Valley, in the West Bank, what it means for any prospect for a two-state solution. The Obama administration, the U.S. government official position is that the solution to the Palestinian issue is for the Palestinians to have some state of some type with very, very limited rights and very limited sovereignty, but a state nonetheless in the area of the West Bank and Gaza and perhaps East Jerusalem. I mean, is a two-state solution still viable? Was it ever viable?
Well, I would actually say, Brian, as you just alluded to, it never really was viable. It never spoke to the rights, desires, and needs of the Palestinian people. And in fact, it shows, you know, the significance of Israel's hunger to grow. And Israel talks openly about greater Israel and we've said earlier, has consistently maintained an expansionist policy. And so even within Israel, you know, there's always been a kind of tongue-in-cheek approach to making mention of a two-state solution. The only solution that the so-called two-state solution offered the Zionists was the ability to maintain and, in fact, expand the occupation with the diplomatic cover of the Oslo Accords, which, by the way, have long since expired. And so, not to mention the fact that Israel has, I don't know how many countless times, violated the accords. But a two-state solution was never viable. It doesn't speak to the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. The so-called two-state solution, as it was proposed, left the Palestinians with a very small percentage of historic Palestine that wasn't even connected, had no geographic continuity whatsoever. It would be little more than, you know, frankly, Bantustans. And that was never acceptable. Now, it might be good for Obama or whoever else to speak to what their ambition might be for the Palestinian people. However, that doesn't equate to the Palestinian ambitions for ourselves. Yeah, which is to say anything short of true independence, democracy, a truly free Palestinian nation for the Palestinian people on all of the historic land of Palestine.
In our last minute and a half, I want to ask you, President Obama, the U.S. government, they say they're for a two-state solution. Everything that the Israeli government has done has made that really impossible. And you said it was never really viable for the Palestinians from the point of view of their national aspirations. But even from, and this is my point, even from the point of view of the Obama administration, the Israelis are not going along. Can you see a point in time whereby the Israeli government, which now is the beneficiary of the largest amount of U.S. foreign aid of any government, could start to go in an independent or different path from the United States? Or could the United States, which has treated Israel as a strategic asset, begin to see it as a strategic liability in that part of the world?
Well, I think that's a question that the American people have to answer. And that's kind of connected to how, you know, we here in the States start to hold our government more accountable. But I will tell you this, that, you know, as far as Israel being a liability or asset to the United States, as we said earlier, part of what brings the American and Israeli agendas together are their shared vision of, frankly, you know, just an expansionist and never-ending expansionist strategy. And so Israel has never been shy about talking about greater Israel from the beginning. And Obama and others, you know, in the American government and different parts of Europe may talk about how dangerous some Israeli positions lately have been towards making the two-state solution, you know, no longer viable. Even within Israel, frankly, some, you know, liberal Zionists and others, going back as far as 10 years, have actually warned that if Israel persists in its current policies on the ground, the two-state solution will no longer be viable.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank Mahmoud Ahmed for joining us. We'll be back on Monday. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear.
Loud and clear.